Welcome back to the show. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters on Background Briefing. Joining us now is Professor Alan Tomlinson, Head of Research in the Chelsea School at Britain's University of Brighton. His work focuses predominantly on the social history of sport, sociology and cultural studies. He previously was editor of the journal International Review for the Sociology of Sport. Welcome, Alan Tomlinson.
Hello. Nice to talk to you, Toby. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks for joining us. Alan, I wanted to talk to you a bit about the World Cup of Men's Football, and I'm going to call it football instead of soccer, just because I think that's easier for you and me and maybe even some of our listeners. But if I lapse
indeed,
into soccer...
Yeah, it is. We get quite a lot of North American students in Brighton, and I teach a few of them as well at Cambridge, and I'm very used to saying soccer.
Oh, well, if you can say soccer, that makes it all the easier for some of our listeners, maybe most of them.
Yeah.
Alan, this World Cup is coming up next year. Just this week, we've seen a number of final qualification matches, and in fact, the USA has qualified for the finals, which will be next year in Brazil. I wanted to ask you about some of the controversies surrounding the World Cup. And I know you're an expert on this going way, way back. Let's talk about FIFA, the Fédération Internationale de Football Association, and it's the governing body internationally, and various charges of corruption that surround it, and in particular some of the folks involved in the Americas. What's the story there with FIFA?
The story with FIFA is a fascinating story from the creation of a body in 1904, comprising seven European nations. Some of those nations were represented by clubs rather than national associations, but seven founding nations, didn't include Britain actually, didn't include any of those British teams for a couple of years, but really trying to standardise the rules so that we could play international sport together. So people wanted to be able to say that soccer could be understood wherever you went to take on some international rival. In Britain, it had happened, obviously, between England, Scotland, Wales, and parts of the islands. What people really wanted was to understand that they had a shared understanding of those rules when they met. And then what was interesting, of course, was that soccer also got a big grip, not in North America initially, but in the South Americas, in Uruguay in particular, and Argentina, and of course Brazil, where the game is next year. And so in 1916, a federation was founded for South American national associations. And they worked along with FIFA, the world body, because the European group called itself the world body.
Very modest.
Quite a number of years, yeah. And the first, what happened was a lot of arguing between bits of the emerging world, the established European nations and so on. And then FIFA really got quite big once it established this Men's Football World Cup, Toby, in 1930, when the French boss of FIFA didn't really have any offers locally in Europe, and they encouraged the Uruguayans, who were top team, double Olympic champions, to stage the first World Cup, and only four nations from Europe managed to get there in 1930, and Uruguay won it. Now the interesting thing about this, of course, is that it's an incremental growth in terms of global significance and reach of what FIFA did and does. And in the 30s, it was in a way it was grabbed by fascism, by Mussolini and Italy. Double men's World Cup champions in the 30s was Italy under Mussolini. But increasingly in the post-colonial period and the post-World War II period and the establishing of these other continental federations, including one for North and Central Americas, it's obviously become a very, very big deal, and it's become the world men's World Cup has become FIFA's highly dependable cash cow because of how much it now attracts in revenue from broadcasters and sponsors.
So from fairly From fairly modest beginnings as an attempt to standardise rules and set up an international competition, it's become one of the most significant parts of civil society around the world. The question is, when you get cash, normally, in my experience, you also get corruption. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, you do. And it happens at times, you know, as soon as the cash arrives, quite early. So one of the top first, not presidents, but top, what we now call a CEO, chief of the FIFA admin, however tiny it was in the early 30s, ran off with a kitty at one point in the early 30s, and that was kind of hushed up, and he was nudged aside, and then FIFA was moved over. But these were not huge sums then. Once in the 1980s, when certain other things were going on in sport, of course, whether it was IMG and International Management Group and in the States and golf and some other sports. But really in the 80s, what really took off was the new golden triangle of the sports event, the international satellite-driven broadcasters, and the professional marketing people who moved in to work on deals and broadcasting. And when some people saw quite what the scale of rewards and personal aggrandizement could be in the 1980s, particularly through the man who ran Adidas then, Horst Dassler, it really became a matter of deal-making and an absolute lack of transparency of financial dealings in a new gold rush in terms of global sport.
And, of course, now we've got a situation where we've got a World Cup upcoming in Brazil, in which there have been mass protests across the country against the use of public funds locally to create a World Cup infrastructure when they could be better allocated towards the everyday needs of ordinary people. Now, Brazil is meant to be the most football-mad place in the world. So what's going on there, do you think?
What's going on is some kind of strange, it's not a collusion, but some strange compromise between, or a balance between the passion for the game, and in a place like Brazil, it is such a huge, huge passion, the game, and having won the World Cup, not in 1950, but in 58, and then after that become the main winner of the men's soccer World Cup, that passion is entrenched. But at the same time, people have become more and more aware of how some of the FIFA people, you know, the people who come into FIFA on committees, some of the people who run FIFA, such as the current President Sepp Blatter, his predecessor, a Brazilian, Joao Havelange, people become more aware of quite how much these people were taking for themselves and creating extraordinary lifestyles of luxury with an unaccountability thrown in as well from their life. So people are becoming aware of this more and more. So the contradiction between the passion of the game and critique of what the game is being used for by others, you know, at certain times it was governments, and way we've just been discussing it, it was not just governments, but it's self-aggrandizing entrepreneurs. So people are saying, excuse me, hold on, we're not accepting the old bread and circuses argument anymore. And in Brazil, this is what really, really happened earlier this year at the Confederations Cup, which was the kind of rehearsal for the men's soccer finals of the World Cup next summer, that some people went out, Pelé went out and said, look, you know, play the game. And the game is what counts. Don't worry about the infrastructure of your society. And he was taken by real surprise, Toby, because people said, excuse me, including players in the national side, the people have a point here. If so much money is flowing into FIFA, how come the nation, comparable to the Olympics at times as well, the nation has to pay so much itself to make these things happen?
I'm speaking with Professor Alan Tomlinson, Head of Research in the Chelsea School at Britain's University of Brighton. We're talking about the Men's World Cup of Soccer / Football, which has its big finale in Brazil next year. Alan, I wonder if I could also ask you about some controversial decisions for future locations of World Cup finals, particularly in Qatar, where we're talking about, in Fahrenheit, 120-degree weather for football matches and for fans. What's that all about?
Well, it's about at least two things. Yeah, one is that FIFA has managed to stick to a mission across different historical epochs. Its mission is to expand the game, what we'd call it, globalise the game, say that soccer, among other team sports, is good for people, it's good for character building, it can be linked to all sorts of forms of intercultural understanding. And it's been able to sell that same message throughout and strengthen that message by saying, excuse me, it shouldn't always be in the areas of the world that they're already the richest ones, the most privileged ones, and therefore it's fantastic to have a World Cup in, you know, Asia. Again, an Olympics comparison with South Korea in 1988. And so to say we've had a World Cup in Africa, the first one in Africa, South Africa in 2010, and then back to Brazil, in a way, because it's been there once before. But then to say, actually, we're not going to go back to England, stroke Britain, or the US or Australia. We're going to go to parts of the world we've not been to before. Yeah. So you can carry the argument that actually having the first ever soccer World Cup for men, the full World Cup, they've had under-17s and for practices for a long time in the certain Gulf states, but to say that we're taking it there fulfills its global mission. Of course, these things don't happen very quickly, and since societies like Qatar and the United Arab Emirates hit oil, and became extraordinarily rich, and that could change the prospects of their theocratic structures and their ruling dynasties. Sport has been seen by such societies as an extraordinarily useful means of what we all now call soft power, following Joseph Nye. We'll do all this for sport. Come and have a great time here. And don't ask us questions about whatever it is, democratic rights, homosexual rights, citizen rights, gender rights, or what have you. And so something very interesting is happening there, because FIFA can continue to sell its message despite the fact that those who are really playing into that message stand for the very opposite of what its big message is in terms of peace, understanding and equality and democracy.
We've also seen horrendous revelations in the last month of death and appalling working conditions, living conditions, if one can even call them that, for the migrant workers who are building the infrastructure of the World Cup in Qatar, haven't we?
Yeah, that is tragic. I mean, what worries you most, more than anything, is that actually those sorts of practices, when you see them revealed, it also reveals them as quite normal, actually, but not usually covered. And the kind of labouring, the mobility of cheap labour in societies like Qatar and the UAE and elsewhere is frightening. And, of course, what people immediately say is, well, sorry, these are aberrations. We will clear it up. We don't want that or anything like that. But of course, the very fact that those sorts of forms of exploitation were happening is revealing in itself.
Is FIFA, in fact, now a corporation rather than a non-government organisation? Is it really there, effectively,
well,
to make money?
It acts in some ways. You know, I've spoken to a lot of people, Toby, in the hierarchy since the early to mid-1990s about this. And Joao Havelange, the Brazilian, with his deals with Coca-Cola, most of them orchestrated by setback to the current president, is being employed by FIFA since 1975, when he was first brought into the organisation. They've brought in money, they've survived certain crises, the bankruptcy of certain partners and this, that, and the other, but they've managed to operate a business model, but remain in Switzerland, of course, where there are a lot of privileges, tax privileges, bank secret privileges and so on. It's infamously the country that harbored Nazi gold for many, many, many decades. They've managed to claim, despite all that kind of huge expansion of revenue, never called profits, actually, forms of surplus, to keep selling the message and keep the status in Switzerland of essentially a charity, a non-profit-making activity. And the question there is whether, in fact, that level of hypocrisy ought to be tolerated for much longer.
Now, we've mentioned a couple of times in our conversation, Alan, that this is about men's football, men's soccer, which obviously is the glamorous side of FIFA's work. What about women's football, women's soccer? Here in the United States, we've regularly had world champion teams, and it's certainly a popular spectator as well as participant sport. Where does women's football stand in the FIFA galaxy?
Well, again, FIFA has taken it on, which is important. I mean, FIFA backs it with certain resources, but you know, to take the economic term that I used earlier about the men's soccer World Cup being the cash cow, nearly everything else that FIFA offers or supports or stimulates and promotes under its label is essentially a loss leader. And what FIFA gains from supporting the Women's Soccer World Cup is masses of good publicity, because it seems to be breaking some old moulds and so on of masculinity domination by men and so on this. But what it does without very much expense at all, really. I mean, the FIFA finances in the high billions remain very, very resistant to any form of transparent understanding, but for a very low cost, they can get a massive amount of publicity for backing the women's game. And then, you know, Sepp Blatter quite ridiculously some years ago did say at one point, well, we're doing all we can, but if the women's game perhaps included people wearing women wearing skimpier shorts, they might get more audiences. So there's this clown-like understanding of what the women's game is on one hand, but also an institutional backing for it, which of course has created a fantastic market, because the encounters between Japan and the USA women's team in soccer in the Olympics and the World Cup have been fantastic in recent years. And at one point they set a world record that's always going to be exceeded, isn't it, month by month, but the world record for tweets in the last moments of one of those encounters.
Well, thanks very much, Alan Tomlinson. It's been great speaking to you.
Okay, it's very, very good to speak to you. I hope that the West Coast audience is interested in these rather interesting questions about soccer.
We absolutely are. I've been speaking with Professor Alan Tomlinson, Head of Research in the Chelsea School at the University of Brighton. His work focuses predominantly on the social history of sport, sociology and cultural studies, and previously he was editor of the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters. He'll be back next Monday. The program is available at ianmasters.com. I'll return tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Thanks to Graham Fitzgibbon in the soundproof booth for production services, and bye for now.
One more light goes out.